There's a perennial fascination with how entrepreneurs differ from the rest of us. However, the focus of research and management practice up until this point has been mainly on quantifying their behaviors or capturing their subjective descriptions of how they think. These insights, whilst fascinating, don't get us to the foundation of why they are different and how they see the world. And indeed, if we can develop our mindsets to become more like them, more entrepreneurial. In this bonus episode, we listen into a conversation between two colleagues, psychologist Emma Sinclair and cognitive neuroscientist Emily Clements, who is leading one of the world's first studies into the neuroscience of entrepreneurs. In it, they explore a key foundation for tomorrow's leaders, building mindsets to navigate uncertainty and improve their capacity for disruptive thinking. I hope you enjoy it. Over to Emma.
Hello and welcome. In this conversation, I'm joined by Emily Clements, who is a cognitive neuroscientist and a core member of our community. And over the past few months, Emily and I have been doing a lot of work together and talking about disruptive thinking. And we pose the question to explore here in this conversation, what is it to be a disruptive thinker? What does it mean to be disruptive? How can we drive forward new ideas into uncertain territory? And what are some of the insights that neuroscience can provide to help us harness the power of our brain to be a change maker? Over the past 2 years, disruption has not been far away from many of us, and particularly leaders who continue to face new challenges on a seemingly daily basis that might be understanding a new landscape for how their organizations and teams will work in the future, or how to problem solve or generate new ideas together in an environment of continuous and growing attentional demand. Disruptive thinking is a core topic that Emily brings into her work every day, and we're going to hear here about the work Emily is currently doing and explore what it means to do positive disruptive thinking and what is happening within our brains along two networks in particular that are involved when we switch between different forms of thinking, zooming in to engage our multiple demand network and zooming out to engage our default mode network. So let's get started and welcome Emily. And Emily, perhaps you can begin by introducing yourself and what you're currently working on.
Lovely to be here. So my name's Emily Clements. I'm a neuroscientist and I'm currently doing my PhD in the neuroscience of entrepreneurship. So I've spent the kind of last few years studying people in our society that have the most disruptive minds. And I kind of believe key insights into how the brain works could help us all develop a deeper sense of self-awareness of how we make decisions. And more importantly, how we can make better, more unique decisions that kind of align with our long-term goals. Over the last few years, I've really kind of been drilling down into what is it that makes someone an entrepreneur or able to think in that way. And my background is as a cognitive neuroscientist. So this kind of means looking at how people think and what goes on in the brain when they're thinking certain types of ways. So I've run some studies where we have given, you know, large sets of kind of cognitive tests and questionnaires that tap into things like personality as well. And kind of have been working with this huge data set to try and drill down into kind of what is it about the kind of cognitive personality profile of someone that allows them to be kind of really entrepreneurial or disruptive in this way. And excitingly, at the moment, we are going to be using the kind of insights from this cognitive testing we did online to get a bunch of entrepreneurs and put them in an MRI scanner and kind of test some of the hypotheses and assumptions I have about kind of how people can think in this creative way. And yeah, really drill down into the science that there hasn't been a lot of so far, and seeing how people, perhaps more in the world of work and in their careers and things like that, actually what is happening in their brain that allows them to disrupt or be successful, and whether we can see that in the brain at all.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. I know that that is something that you're currently right in the mix of doing. So really excited to hear more about that when the results are out, you've got more that you're able to share. But I think you drew on something really important there, which is that often, you know, disruption can feel quite a negative phrase or a negative word. And even in my introduction, that context of, you know, mass disruption that's happened over the course of the last 2 years, it always feels like that's a kind of constant change that's happening to us. But I think the frame that you brought there is actually, what does it mean to be a disruptive thinker? And the difference between, you know, disruption and entrepreneur, you put the two together and suddenly there's a positive element to that. So that's the bit we were really wanting to get into as we were thinking this through, and the work that we're currently doing with leaders. How can we turn that into something that is useful? How can we be a disruptive thinker? So it'd be brilliant to start perhaps, Emily, with like, well, what is disruptive thinking? And why is it taking you on this quest to work with some of the entrepreneurs that you're with today?
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head there with the fact that kind of shifting it from thinking about disruption as something that happens to us as something that we can actually do. And I think it can often be the hardest thing to feel like doing that. How do you disrupt? How do you kind of come up with something completely unique? And I'd say what disruptive thinking is that kind of sweet spot in human decision making. So where you can kind of evaluate and understand a situation, but also come up with creative and useful solutions. And, you know, in the world of work, disruptive thinkers are essential to adapting and growth. And particularly as you kind of spoke about in the introduction, with this massive shift that's happened in the world of work at the moment, to kind of come out the other side and kind of deal with all these things that we might have, like the kind of Zoom fatigue that everyone might be feeling, you know, you've got to kind of start to think in a more disruptive way about how we can address these challenges and how we can kind of move forward after so much disruption that has happened to us.
And I think there's something in the element of disruption when we were talking in the past that it's kind of is constant. You're never going to get to the end of feeling like you're over a, like a hump of, you know, this is just got to get through this. It's actually in our everyday work, just the amount of information that's coming at us, the amount of, I don't know about you, but the number of things that you get sent to you in your inbox via, you know, WhatsApp, on LinkedIn, all media channels are available. But the, you know, the ability to actually switch off or switch between some of that information is really fascinating too. But that takes its toll, I should think, from a, you know, on the brain as much as anything. How do we actually use that sense of switching to be able to overcome some of that thinking? So Emily, it'd be amazing just to understand what brain mechanisms are coming into play when we go against the grain. And I really like that phrase that you used, the brain against the grain.
Yeah, it sounds good. So, I mean, neuroscientists for years have been using brain imaging techniques to unpick kind of areas and networks in the brain that help us problem solve. And kind of from this research, we can start to see that the same areas and networks are kind of consistently involved in different types of thinking.
Can I just pause you there? Because the phrase networks, I know that I've been on a bit of a journey in our conversations to just understand areas of brain and this concept of networks. Is it possible just to do a little, maybe a little fly through 101 for us before we get going?
Definitely. Because I mean, often when you talk about neuroscientist findings, we just start throwing like, oh, the inferior frontal gyrus and all of this. And, you know, I know the names to someone not from the field mean nothing. So, yeah, we kind of, especially in the way that I study the brain, I kind of speak a lot about networks and regions within the brain. So essentially something a lot of people might know is we have two hemispheres. So you have the right and the left hemisphere in your brain. They're kind of separated in your head and they're connected by something called the corpus callosum. And then each hemisphere is made up of four main lobes. So you have the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the temporal lobe, and the occipital lobe. And broadly, these lobes are kind of known to have slightly different functions. So the occipital lobe is kind of involved in vision. The frontal lobe is where a lot of our kind of like higher order thinking comes from. And we kind of used to speak a lot about a very kind of modular, like a region of the brain, and mm-hmm. what the involvement of that region was when, like, if you think like this, is it that area in your frontal cortex? But I'd say the field has moved on a lot from that. And nowadays we talk a lot about networks. So we'll speak about how different regions within the different lobes and hemispheres of our brain kind of talk to each other and connect with each other. And, you know, when you hear something like the inferior frontal gyrus, all that kind of means is it's almost a name that's given to the location of it. So frontal means it's in the frontal lobe. Inferior kind of means it's on like the bottom portion, whereas superior would be on the top. And gyrus is basically the kind of, if you've ever looked at a brain, you can see it's kind of all folded in and out. And a gyrus is the bit that folds out, and a sulcus or sulci are the bits that kind of fold in. So although the names sound very complicated, they're kind of just like a location map of like, okay, where are we talking about here?
I love the fact that you can just locate areas of the brain by you won't be able to see this if you're listening to this, but literally have just had Emily moving her hands around just in this kind of space and already got an idea. Brilliant, thank you. So networks then, you use the word almost like the communication between areas of the brain and the networks. So that, is that what we're focusing in on when we're thinking about disruptive types of thinking?
Yeah, so in terms of disruptive thinking, what I want to speak about a bit today is these two kind of networks that we have in the brain when we kind of engage different types of thinking. So one to start with is called the multiple demand network. And this is one way we can kind of think about this network is perhaps I'm going to call it like our zooming in mode. So when we think about focusing very intently on a task at hand, this is kind of controlled by a network of regions in our brain called the multiple demand network. And this is a lot in our frontoparietal region. So that basically means, you know, how our frontal regions are connected and speaking with parietal regions. And these kind of switch on when a task is quite demanding of our attention and perhaps quite difficult. And we're calling this a zoom in state of the brain as it kind of zooms in on the details and the problem to solve. And the multiple demand network and its kind of engagement is actually one of our greatest strengths as humans. You know, it underlies much of what's called our kind of fluid intelligence. So this is our ability to analyze, problem solve, stay engaged in tasks, and be productive.
So how often are we using this multiple demand network? What kind of percentage of an average day is someone using that, would you say?
I'd say that when we're working, it's probably what we're engaging most of the time when we're really kind of focusing in on tasks. I mean, as long as you're kind of not procrastinating. But, you know, when you notice that you've really been working on a problem and a task for like quite a long time, you know, in a 7-hour day, maybe you are doing that for 4 to 5 hours of the day. I think they often say 4 hours is the actual time that they find people are being productive and doing the work during the workday. And it's not that it's like, you know, not good. It is a super, super useful way of thinking. And, you know, I spoke about our kind of fluid intelligence. And this is kind of, yeah, our ability to problem solve and direct attention. And it's quite different to something we call our crystallized intelligence, which is kind of what you learn in school and what information or outside of school, but it's the knowledge and the information that you learn. And that's the kind of thing that classic intelligence tests kind of measure you on. Whereas fluid intelligence and kind of your ability to problem solve is just, it's a slightly different like type of cognition, and it's kind of how flexible you can be between switching states.
Problem solving is something that's absolutely key and identified as one of the key skills for anybody coming into the workforce at the moment, but also for anyone to succeed. And you can understand why in you know realms of uncertainty, how you can only really deal with that through working through problems. And it sounds like my understanding is that this multiple demand network is the bit that we are engaging in when we're trying to work through a task, something perhaps that we haven't done before or requires us to really zoom in, as you say, on that core detail. I mean, do you have any examples of it feels like the hard task that we're talking about here? Yeah. And I love the fact that you said you're doing it when you're not procrastinating. And I feel like that might be where you're going to go with us next. Yeah. But, you know, what would you define as a hard task?
I think, obviously, depending on people's jobs, there's so many. A classic one that I always use, because everybody did it in school, is, you know, solving a maths problem. It's something that you've got to really focus on.
I hate maths problems.
But potentially when we kind of come to the world of work, it might be a little bit more like, I think we spoke before about planning and scheduling things, or I don't know, you have a problem in a piece of code, or you're writing a script, or you need to fix, like, your website's down and you need to fix it. And it's essentially those kind of, I think, those day-to-day problems that are constantly arising in our work. And they're super important to fix and solve. It's not that we should just kind of completely disregard them. But I do think that when we are zooming in so much and getting so bogged down in the details, sometimes we can lose that wider view and vision of actually kind of what are our goals here and what are we trying to achieve? And is the work that we're doing in this zoomed in state using our multiple demand network every day actually serving the wider view and the wider picture? And I think, you know, something you can often observe is actually maybe not sometimes within an individual, but within a team, that sometimes you do need the people working on the very specific problems. But if you just had them, the kind of movement of the team or the company forward might falter. You know, they wouldn't be coming up with creative and disruptive ways of thinking. They would just be fixing the problem every day.
That is a really useful frame, actually. It's so, I can see that when I work with teams, it's those individuals perhaps where they're in that moment where they're really zoomed in, they've got the task, they're working on it and working towards the kind of the end goal of it. And then you'll all inevitably, because in the way that a teams work, you never just get to the end goal by, you know, the path that you originally set at the very beginning. There's always, you know, curveballs or things that come in that you have to be able to factor into your thinking as well. So what's the flip side to this? What's the other?
So we've spoken about zooming in, and I guess the flip side of that is zooming back out. And it kind of speaks even to what we spoke about in the beginning when we were talking about being disrupted versus disrupting. So we can think that in the zoom in mode, we're often reacting to the disruption that is happening to us. So perhaps if we think about how we can disrupt, we have to think about zooming out a bit and getting that wider kind of vision. So in kind of theories of creativity, there is a network in the brain, which is called the default mode network. And these have been shown to involve in our kind of self-referential thoughts and memories that we have. So when we can kind of zoom out from the very specific problems we're facing, and our kind of internal monologue starts to commence, that's when you are engaging the default mode network. And, you know, we've all kind of been there when you're, I don't know, watching a presentation or even listening to a podcast, and something they say kind of sparks a memory or something in you, and you find yourself kind of daydreaming and drifting off into that kind of internal thought process. And, you know, this area of this kind of network in the brain was actually discovered years ago in between experiments, when neuroscientists had people in an MRI scanner. And they found that when kind of in between tasks, participants were just laying there and they weren't being asked to do anything, this same kind of network of regions was activating. And this is kind of made up of the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate gyrus, and something called the angular gyrus. But also, like, a lot of the default mode network in these regions overlap with the kind of like your memory system. So it really is when you're kind of looking in and thinking about your memories and how a context kind of relates to that.
So I'd love to just understand a little bit more about this self-referential thought, you know, and bringing that to life. And you mentioned the connection of memory and the fact that this was spotted as people, you know, were waiting for a task, almost, you know, anticipating something coming, but not, you know, if you're in a scanner, I'm guessing they can't be doing anything immediately at that moment. So their brain is doing something in that, you know, in that state. But what I find fascinating about that is that your brain is constantly active. So it's always doing something. Is that true? Is that fair?
Yeah. Again, like, hit the nail on the head. So we've spoken about the default mode network, and, you know, in a scanner particularly, that could be when you give someone a hard problem or a maths problem or a cognitive task they need to solve. And there will be, you know, regions and activations in the multiple demand network. And then on the flip side, they thought, okay, well, when you're not doing anything, does your brain just kind of switch off? Does the activity dial down? and in fact, it doesn't, but it just starts engaging a different network, which can actually sometimes be called the resting state network, because it is when people are resting inside the scanner. And sometimes, you know, people just put a kind of fixation cross and just instruct the participants to stare at the cross. And of course, that's not a very hard or engaging task. So when people start to stare at the cross, their mind just starts wandering and they'll go into that kind of default mode network, self-referential thoughts. And it, yeah, I'm kind of probing more into this network over the years from what they first discovered. Was it's kind of not just involved in daydreaming, but also, you know, I mentioned it's connected to your long-term memory systems. And they even perhaps think to kind of creative processes within the brain. It's kind of essentially engaged when you think about past events or beliefs or even biases that you have or long-term goals, and how this kind of information connects with your sense of self and who you are.
I feel like we need to dig into this somehow and work out a route into it, because I'm personally just really interested in that concept of sense of self and how you're getting access to something that's already within you. That's almost like you're constantly building who you are by just engaging in, I guess, reflection might fall into that space too.
Definitely. And it's a kind of side note, but there's really interesting research that has linked overactivity in the default mode network and this kind of sense of self to things like depression. Because often, like, what happens in depression is people become very internally focused, and they often actually kind of struggle to, like, downregulate that, like, thought process that is going on kind of inside. And studies have, they've kind of shown that there is an overactivity in the default mode network. So while I'm, you know, now saying it's good for creative processes, it's kind of all about the balance between these. And again, like, really off on a side note, but so interestingly, there's something called a neurofeedback, which is essentially where you get someone an MRI scanner, you kind of display a task on the screen, but that task is connected to activity in their brain. And you have to try and train them to kind of down-regulate activity in certain regions. So they have started to do this in depression to see if they can get people to train their own brain to kind of down-regulate that default mode network and that really kind of self-referential thought process that might actually lead to the things like rumination and the kind of thoughts that make depression worse. And it's still a very, like, emerging stream of research, but it's just, I find it so fascinating.
So out of interest, if you're in deep meditation, which network are you operating in there?
They have put people meditating in, or tried to put them in MRI scanners, or, you know, connect EEG and see what's happening. From someone who meditates myself, like, I have thought about this, And it's interesting because some meditations are really about directing attention. So if you are really focusing and directing attention, I'd say that that might be a little bit more like the multiple demand network. It's almost like you, like I sometimes see meditation as training yourself to focus in on one task. Because, you know, we spoke about, you know, the demand that we have in our lives nowadays for our attention and how it's being drawn from all directions. But if you can learn to really just, you know, focus in, say it's a meditation, it's your breathing for that period of time. And I actually think that what happens when you get distracted in meditation is your default mode network. Like if your eyes are closed and then suddenly you realize you start just going off on this like daydreaming process. And then part of the meditation is to kind of bring it back to the focus, which might be the breath. Mm-hmm. And then as you do that more again, it's not a super, you know, when we speak about cognitive tasks and maths problems, focusing on your breathing is not a super hard task. So you might find again that you're more likely to start wandering off and then you have to kind of bring it back. So I kind of see meditation as a way of training yourself to switch between the states and basically be able to focus your attention fully on a task. But at the same time, I from someone who meditates, my mind always wanders. Like I'm always going down the self-referential thought stream.
So we've got two networks that we've talked about here then. We've got our zooming in, which multiple demand network, and when you're really focused on that task, feels quite energy intensive, and you know, use that concept of the hard task, you know, really zooming in, and those teams that you said, you know, it could be that individual that's really focused in on the task and someone else brings in more detail. And then you got the zooming out side, which is the default mode network, which I think you gave a really good example there of those individuals perhaps in a brain scanner where they're not, you know, asked not to do anything and the brain just starts to take them into different places, self-referential thought and the like. So two networks that have been identified as important by the sounds of it for thinking and for disruptive thinking in itself. So why? Like what have these brain networks got to do with disruptive thinking? Why are they important?
You know, I think both of these brain networks are important to enable disruptive thinking. To be disruptive means to kind of be creative in our approach to problems. You know, I spoke about that kind of sweet spot where you've evaluated and engaged in a task enough to understand it, but perhaps you can start to think of a way that, yeah, just kind of gets ahead of the curve a bit and thinks about it slightly differently. And I think like the easiest way to kind of understand, especially why the default mode network and mind wandering might be needed, is because we all know that forcing creativity can feel near to impossible. If someone just goes like, come up with a creative idea, like on the spot right now, unless you are, I don't know, a comedian or an improvised actor, most of us really struggle to kind of force it out of us. And I kind of think this is because when we want to be creative in that way, we still approach the problem with our multiple demand mind and network. You know, we still think if I can focus enough on this problem, I can come up with a great idea. And the more we try and force ideas, the more stressed and frustrated, you know, we're using up that brain energy to really try and force something out. And this is why kind of theories of creativity are increasingly being rooted in the ability to zoom out and engage the default mode network. And in fact, there have been studies where neuroscientists have shown that highly creative individuals have a greater connectivity between frontal area of the brain called the left inferior frontal gyrus and the entire kind of default mode network. So what this starts to show us is that when you have a kind of greater cooperation between the default mode network and a kind of perhaps some frontal areas of the brain that are evaluating the problem, the more creative an individual is able to be.
So taking all that in, is it true to say, maybe it isn't, but I'm going to follow this train of thought, that maybe highly creative individuals are actually somehow changing the way that their brain is operating and I'm going to use the word functioning potentially incorrectly, but this, you know, the fact that you can see those stronger connections, is that a naive thing to consider? We can make our brains more creative.
It's a really interesting point. I don't think people are consciously changing the way their brain functions unless they are hooked up to an MRI machine doing a neurofeedback study, where that's the kind of goal to do that. I think kind of potentially in these studies, what you're seeing is correlation. It's very difficult to prove causation. So what that means is, like, we can show that people who are more creative might have kind of better connectivity with the default mode network and with those regions. But you can't really, from those studies, say, okay, so were they more creative in the first place? Like, did they have that stronger connection in their brain already, and that's why they are highly creative? Or have they engaged in so many creative activities because that is, you know, their job, or that is kind of what they were drawn to or motivated to do, that as a consequence, these networks have become stronger in their brain? Essentially, we don't know the answer to that without running very longitudinal studies where you kind of, you know, you get people at the beginning and you give them lots of creative stuff and see if the connections and networks in their brain change. But I would say my inclination is that there is obviously an element of nature in our brain and how it's formed, but I sit a lot more on the kind of nurture side. So I think the experiences in our lives really do nurture and shape our brain. And I'm talking like right from childhood. We know that early childhood experiences and things like that can actually cause like structural differences in the brain. Mm-hmm. So, it's not so far to think that the experiences that you have from a young child and through your education and even as a young adult and an adult and so on kind of shape the way that your brain is able to function.
So it feels like this is still an emerging area, and this is the bit that gets really interesting for like the work that we do in terms of how can we enable, perhaps think about consciously building a mindset that enables us to be, you know, more creative. And you touched on that thought of, and I appreciate it's a thought at this stage, that is it the fact that we've just engaged in more creative, you know, creative activity? And I'm making an assumption here that that's potentially what you might start to be seeing in the work that you're doing in your PhD, almost like a bit of a hypothesis that might be working through that as well. But have you come across anywhere with from the world of neuroscience, kind of what's a creative practice or a creative task that actually builds that? And I don't know, you might not have an answer.
It's definitely something that I'm actively kind of doing in my work at the moment, is looking at this concept of kind of creativity in the brain. And, you know, as kind of mentioned, that this disrupt thinking is this kind of sweet spot where you kind of evaluate it and understand it and have come up with a creative solution. I think there's a study that was done in 2012 that actually links quite well with the kind of like this idea of zooming out and zooming back in. So this guy called Benjamin Bard asked people to complete a classic test of creativity, which is called the unusual uses task, sometimes the alternative uses task. Basically in this task, very simple, people just have to come up with as many uses as possible for a very common object. So, you know, I could give you a brick and maybe I'll ask you on the spot, I'll give you a brick and, you know, give me five uses for a brick.
Okay. Five uses for a brick. Doorstop.
Yeah.
Probably build a house, tiny part of a house. Here's a random one for environmentalists. Put it in your cistern of the toilet so that you doesn't fill with so much water.
Oh.
Learned that one the other day. Right, that's three random ones. Two, keeping the lid on the wheelie bin that I can see outside the window in the wind. And a final one, giving you extra height to reach something in a cupboard.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, I mean, there was some quite creative ones there. But so essentially you kind of give people a set amount of time and they have to kind of list as many, and then you kind of mark them for, so you can assess people for things like fluency. So right. I'd say you were quite fluent there, like in terms of how kind of fluently and quickly could you like draw off all these ideas, or were there like some real pauses and stunts? You obviously look for the uniqueness of the ideas. So, you know, building a house, building a wall might be less creative, whereas I think putting it in the toilet was very, I've never heard of that. And yeah, you essentially, you know, people are asked to do this to kind of come up, and you can assess someone's kind of creative potential very simply in this kind of lab-based task. So what Barr did in this 2012 study is he kind of split people into three groups, and he gave them, they were kind of shown the object and they noted down their initial ideas. And then they were split so that group one were allowed to rest for 12 minutes. Group two for 12 minutes were given a very simple, like not very demanding or difficult task. And group three were given a very hard task to do for 12 minutes. And after 12 minutes, the three groups came back and they all had to return to the task and try and come up with some more ideas for their initial list. And the results actually showed that the second group, who were given the kind of undemanding task for 12 minutes, showed a 40% rise in creativity compared to the two other conditions. And, you know, the kind of authors and the theory behind why is because the relatively easy task meant their mind could kind of start to wander off the problem at hand. And it might seem surprising, because we've spoken about it, obviously, it's like the resting state network and the default mode, that the rest condition didn't improve their creativity. But the kind of authors of this paper suggested that we actually might need some type of distraction to provoke the optimum amount of mind wandering. And I think we can all relate to this, that if you have absolutely nothing to do, you might actually still think about the problem too much. So, you know, we've kind of all experienced that, where there's a problem at work that you're stuck on, and then you go away and you just find yourself sitting there just still thinking about it. And perhaps what this is suggesting, that you actually need to engage in some other task, which is quite easy to do, but still maybe requires a little bit of attention. But essentially you kind of go into like autopilot mode to really allow the optimal mind wandering. I'm thinking driving might be like a good one, because you obviously are driving,
fully concentrated on the road.
But you know, I'm just thinking about the times when I've been driving and how your mind can just wander to all these thoughts.
No, I like it. That, so in what 12 minutes essentially in this study, managed to change their, I guess, the state that they were. Is that the right phrase? Kind of almost like the brain state that they were operating in?
And I would think so. And like, particularly in this kind of experimental condition, because when you're kind of asked by a scientist to do a task and you want to do it well, and perhaps the slightly undemanding task that they were given in that 12 times was just enough to distract them so that they didn't kind of worry or think too much about coming back to the kind of unusual uses task and coming up with more ideas.
So it's encouraging. It's like encouraging your mind to wander, but keep, you know, enough that you're not using, I mean, you've used the phrase before, like energy to really focus in. Does that feel like a relevant point? Your brain is using so much energy when you're zoomed in versus when you're zoomed out, or at least kind of less cognitive load.
And I guess that's kind of reflected by the fact that the third group in this experiment, who were given the hard task, didn't although they were distracted away from the problem, they didn't increase their kind of creative output at the end. And perhaps that's because the task they were given was demanding. Like, it was hard. And, you know, we can think about this in our work. Like, if you're trying to focus on one problem and you're finding that really hard, and then you think, okay, I'm going to come back to it, I'll go work on something else, but you work on something else which is also hard and requires a lot of attention, you then go back to that first problem, but you haven't allowed any time for the creative processes to occur.
That kind of leads me to a question that's, you know, outside of, as you say, experimental conditions. And we've looked at or the thoughts that, you know, to be creative, or what we're seeing in some of our, you know, creative, and I think we're using creative and disruptive almost simultaneously there. That's which to me feels quite positive based on where we started, you know, the sense that actually, you know, creativity is disruption. I like that. But coming back to thinking about those that can be more creative, those that can be more disruptive are, you know, potentially, we haven't solved this, but potentially able to somehow increase those networks that are enabling them to perhaps move between both modes, both states. And we've seen, even as you say, an experimental task where just in 12 minutes you can change a state. But how can we apply some of that in the real world? You know, how can we all be perhaps more disruptive, more creative, and perhaps to actively like engage both of those brain states optimally, you know, to navigate what we're currently faced with every day?
I think the way you described it made a really important point there at the beginning, that it's a lot of it could potentially be to do with the switching. So how you switch between this type of thinking. And I do think that the awareness of it is that kind of first step. Like, when you become aware, okay, like what type of state, what type of thinking am I engaging here? And this goes both ways, because, you know, I've spoken about how the default mode network, and if that network is overactive, may actually lead to problems like depression or potentially even anxiety. So, you know, sometimes when you, for someone kind of with depression or anxiety, you might actually get them to kind of work to switch back into a slightly more problem-solving state than the real kind of mind-wandering, like self-referential thoughts. And I think in the same way, if you have someone who by tendency stays very engaged in like the problem-focused, focused-in mode, could there be something that people can do to make sure that they do engage the default mode network at times too? And I think kind of one of my favorite neuroscientists and writers, Oliver Sacks, decades ago, so it's not even a kind of new theory, kind of pointed to three essential elements in a creative breakthrough. And these are time, forgetting, and incubation. So essentially, whilst the neuroscience that we've spoken about can seem very complicated in terms of networks and regions and what's going on in the MRI scanner, it kind of does complement and speak to, I think, some very simple practical steps you can take to kind of be a bit more of a disruptive thinker. And, you know, really contrary to popular beliefs, creative breakthroughs and disruptive ideas are not just aha moment, light bulb, spontaneous. You know, in fact, unique ideas are really created by both the time we spend working on the problem and the time we use to step away from the problem, with the kind of continued influence of the world around us and all our experiences that we have. And I think kind of with this, you can start to work out, okay, there's this problem at hand, but if I kind of zoom back out, whatever experience have I had in my life that actually might seemingly be completely unrelated, but potentially like the brick in the toilet, help me work out how to solve this problem. And I just think that's a really good example, because it's two objects that you might not place together, but someone at some point had that creative breakthrough. And yeah, I think just really understanding that can help us get this kind of like deeper sense of self-awareness about how our brain is working. And to be honest, it promotes better work-life balance, because if we know that if we just spend too much time zoomed in, we're not going to get to the, you know, the creative breakthrough or the really disruptive ideas, then we can decide, okay, I'll go for a walk, or I'll go meditate, or I'll go do a task that is probably easier and a bit more fun for a little while, and then I'm going to come back to this really hard problem.
So you identified, and from your one of your most famous and favorite neuroscientists, but time, forgetting, and I must state here that forgetting is in, you know, speech marks, and then incubation. I, from my experience of working with a lot of people, and even personally, I find it really hard to step away when you feel like just sitting there and staring at it will make, you know, will make the difference. But you've got a really compelling reason to, you know, as you say, the moment you step away, other things come into your mind. You know, you've been there before, you've experienced before that, you classed it as like that aha moment. I have something in my arsenal that I can use here, but you can't see that when you're in that mode. And I mean, I just wonder, you talked about perhaps going out for a walk or meditating, but how important is environment for us to get in the right state, or recognize, at least, like you said, raise awareness that we might be in the wrong state for this particular, you know, problem solving task?
Yeah, I'd say environment is really important. So the multiple demand network usually engages when it's very task demanding environment. And okay, we as neuroscientists might look at this in like an MRI scanner when I'm displaying lots of like boxes of stimuli and getting you to tap lots of things. But, you know, in real life, this is being in an office, you know, sitting at your laptop trying to do a piece of work, having someone call over to you and ask you another question, something pinging up on the screen in front of you, your phone buzzing. You know, that is such a task demanding environment, and everything going on is demanding your attention. And there is, it goes off on a different stream, but related, there is so much interesting research in terms of, particularly nowadays, the demand that our lifestyles kind of have on attention. And, you know, in contrast, the default mode network usually engages when this external input around us is much lower. So, you know, when you're having a shower, when you're lying in bed, like these kind of things is where your mind is allowed to wander, because the environment and what's going on around you is not too demanding. So I think when we know that we have a particular problem to solve, or we want to have a creative breakthrough or output, it's really important to consider the environments that we are kind of putting ourselves in, and if that's the best environment for the task at hand. And, you know, I think also, that being said, we kind of know mixing up your environment can help with creativity. And I don't quite know neuroscientifically why this works, but perhaps from what we've spoken about, it does allow this optimal balance between kind of zooming in and zooming out. You know, we kind of spoke about there being enough things to kind of maybe that are new or distract you, but it's not so demanding of your attention that you kind of can allow your mind to wander a bit.
Amazing. I think definitely need to get out more and walk more, actually. I find that people talk about walking meetings, but actually walking to just help you think is quite an important element. In fact, I had that experience the other night, realized I was struggling with something and thought the best thing was to get out there with the dog. And amazingly, you do feel, and I think, you know, it's something we haven't even talked about yet, but sense of, you know, you feel a lot better when you come back and you look at the task afresh.
Yeah. Really interestingly, and it might have even been Oliver Sacks too. I do remember reading or hearing once about, I think it was Oliver Sacks talking about walking, because he loved to walk, but also the speed at which you walk. And you can almost experiment with what it does to your thinking. Like if you kind of walk too slowly, sometimes you can't, like he spoke about in terms of creative breakthroughs and that problem solving, maybe you can't quite get there. But if you get, he was convinced that he had the right pace that he had to walk at to kind of like come up with it. But then if you walk too fast, it, like, you felt too stressed and it just wasn't, like, you know, when you're rushing something. So yeah, I found that concept of walking really interesting, about the demand that you get from the speed that you want to walk at can also potentially affect your thinking and the networks engaged.
Yeah, that suggests to me there's an optimal balance, to your point, on everything, and it's becoming more aware of it. Like, what is, you know, what do I need right now potentially, and you know, why is this hard? So we've talked about the amount of demand that is on, you know, people, and you did a really good example there of, you know, the phone going, TV on, or people in the office coming over to you. Like, constantly things are trying to, you know, drive for our attention. And from what we've been talking about today, when you're trying to zoom in on a particular task, but also know you need to zoom out, and then you've got a distraction that's coming in from, you know, left of field, it's quite a complicated place to be, potentially, for yourself and your brain at that particular moment in time. Is the current demand for our attention meaning that it's harder to, you know, to stay in either mode at any stage?
I guess there isn't really evidence in terms of kind of neuroscience studies showing particularly, like, whether these networks are involved or how they're involved. I guess it would be difficult to do because in an MRI scanner, you know, they're in there for a limited time and have the tasks for the rest period. It would be fascinating if you could somehow scan someone's brain during their work day and watch as their attention switches. But I have heard of research into attention and this idea of, you know, a lot of things kind of demanding our attention. And actually, I mean, people speak quite a lot about kind of flow state, and when you get into kind of like deep work, and that's when you're essentially, what the flow state is when your attention is just so focused in on the task that you're doing. So we can imagine our multiple demand network kind of in overdrive, like we are focused in on this problem, which is super, super useful for, you know, a lot of the work that we do. And actually, what's happening when we have a lot of different kind of stimuli and things pinging and email alerts going on, is every single time that happens, even if we just, okay, like we're focusing on the task and we just suddenly, oh, what's that? And then we read that message or that email and that diverts our attention away. When you then try and come back and re-engage and focus back in, I think, I mean, and I don't know if this kind of statistic is right. I heard on another podcast, they said it takes about 22 minutes to focus back in and get back into that real attention flow state when you're distracted. And I think the kind of point here is that a lot of the time we're not choosing to switch between those states ourselves in our work. We are.
Interesting.
It's being kind of like forced on us by everything that's kind of going on, and we are being disrupted. We are being, you know, our attention is being disrupted. And, you know, I personally feel like this is a real problem. In our work, and I think we kind of all have days ourselves where we do notice it and feel that the distraction around us is just too much. And I do think that when we're kind of engaging the multiple demand network too much, but constantly trying to switch, not between kind of the mind wandering, the switch off, and the attention, but literally just staying in the attention mode and constantly switching that between different things demanding our attention, that is knackering for our brain. And I think that can really create those feelings of stress and cognitive fatigue, sometimes to the point that people become so tired that then they can't even, like, engage the attention at all, and they're procrastinating and they're demotivated and they're trying to work and their mind is just wandering. So it's a really, really good and hard question to answer, is kind of how do we in the modern world that we live in, and with everything that demands our attention, how can we sit back and make the choice of what type of thinking we engage? Because there's obviously external influences going on.
Well, Emily, thank you. I feel like we've gone on a very fast and yet fascinating journey through what it means to be a disruptive thinker, and those two networks, and how we can, you know, consciously or can we, in fact, I think is the question, can we consciously become more aware of those two networks, and when we need to, perhaps change the, our brain state for the task at hand? And I really love what you were talking about in terms of our, creative thinkers also being disruptive thinkers. And I'd love to just kind of pass to you to just, in summary, what can we take away from this? What can leaders take away and start to really, think about or apply over the course of the next couple of weeks as they're in their day-to-day work?
So yeah, as you said, spoken about so much. I find that the neuroscience and kind of speaking a bit about these experiments and what happens in the brain is just a useful kind of basis of like a theoretical understanding of, okay, what is actually going on inside there? And then I think we've spoken about ideas that bring it to life and like, okay, so this is why when you're on a computer and this is happening and when you're trying to solve a problem. And I think the kind of, just learning a little bit about the basics of what is happening in the brain and in neuroscience can really just help us almost sometimes give ourselves a little bit of a break, and maybe actually quite literally in this case. But, I think when you understand the science behind why something is going right or going wrong, you really start to understand, okay, like this is what I need to do to kind of help myself a little bit more in this situation. Or as we've spoken about, gain a little bit more self-awareness of why right now I'm so cognitively fatigued and I can't do this task, and actually what does my brain need? And I think it just kind of comes back to that idea of kind of brain health. I often say, it's become really like popular in recent years for people to understand science a bit more. You see it in nutrition, you see it in even in the pandemic, like in the recent years, it's really shifted that people who weren't kind of perhaps interested in science at all have suddenly started to ask, okay, but what happens in my body? Like, what is this doing? And I think that it can just complement, like, a lot of the stuff was already there. We can understand like why we need to take breaks and things like that. But then I think if you can just add that other layer of biologically what is going on, sometimes it can just help and almost convince people like, okay, I don't need to be so hard on myself. Like, it's not me in this situation. It's like my brain's tired today. And I definitely, knowing this information definitely helps me in my work, because I sometimes get to the point and I just know that there's been too many different things demanding my attention and it's tired and it's not going to solve the problem that I need it to do. And I constantly use the analogy, and I know a lot of people do it, but of, people who go to the gym and muscles, and the fact that even people who go to the gym a lot will take rest days and they will have an awareness of what is happening in their muscles and what nutrition they need to put in their body. And I kind of think the same concepts can be applied to our brain. Like, we can think about what does my brain need? Is it tired? Has it worked too much in this area? Maybe it needs some food and some sleep or to go on a walk and stretch it out. And I think the takeaway for me is to just consider like the things we've spoken about, the different networks in your brain, the different ways they engage, and perhaps what you can do to kind of step back a bit at times.
Well, Emily, thank you very much. We're absolutely delighted that you're helping us to understand this at the level of science. I love the idea that you can take your brain for a walk. I'll leave that with some listeners. And the fact that you are bringing us brain health and brain science, and I have left you with the knowledge of a brick and a system, just sums that up.
I will try that.